This is your Uncle Don here with the 303rd edition of my Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR. This comes to you through the ether at 88.7 FM. I must be one of the few to miss George Wanker Bush. Without him to pillory, I may have to cut my shows to 15 minutes. But I'm reassured that he is not forgotten, nor does he lack a rump of followers. He'll soon be making his first foray beyond the U.S. border when he speaks, for a fee, to a gaggle of fans in, where else, Calgary. Where is Lee Harvey Oswald when we really need him? Or is there a chance of someone pulling off a citizen's arrest in the face of a bunch of Secret Service suits? In a more perfect world, George would be in the dock at The Hague right now. Wouldn't that be sweet? Is the planet growing smaller along with the economy? How else can you explain that two satellites in cross orbits collided in the vastness of outer space? How else could two nuclear submarines in the vastness of the North Atlantic Ocean bump into one another? I must consult with my friends in the Flat Earth Society for their opinion. Maybe they're onto something. On the serious side of that undersea collision, what in hell were those deadly monster submarines doing out there? Those were two submarines, out of how many others we don't know, stealthily plying the world's oceans, each with 24 nuclear-tipped missiles targeted we know not where. A Mr. Lee Willett of the Royal United Services Institute in London, whatever that is, gave the following analysis. These are the strategic crown jewels of the nation. The whole purpose of a sea-based nuclear deterrent is to hide somewhere far out of sight. They're the ultimate tools of national survival in the event of war. Nuclear war? Against whom and to what unimaginable end? What does the destruction of two dozen cities, along with the lives of at least 100 million human beings, have to do with national survival? My God, do these Dr. Strangelove clones still wander the earth? The Cold War was supposed to have ended 20 years ago, and there yet these god-awful machines lurking, each awaiting a signal from some idiot like the unlamented George Wanker Bush to unleash mass murder on 24 innocent cities. I have my own story about those potential purveyors of mass extinction. On one of my visits to my late mother in the States, we were invited to dinner by a neighbor across the street. Their home was decorated with many trophies of a military life of which he was quite proud. He explained that he had been a career officer, a member of a large military family. He boasted that one of his sons was the captain of a Trident submarine known as a Boomer, one of America's contributions to the Cold War's mutual assured destruction. How comforting. He must have been heartened to know his offspring had the means to destroy civilization in the Soviet Union and the lives of those enduring it. Our host and his wife were very gracious, putting on a lavish dinner. During the meal, I noticed one piece of silverware that didn't match the rest. It was a gravy ladle, the handle of which bore a swastika and the initials AH. He affirmed that it was, indeed, the former property of one Adolf Hitler, a souvenir picked up when, as a soldier, he was among the first to visit the Berlin bunker where the Führer met his end. I was grossed out. Bad enough to be in the vicinity of such a tainted item, but to have used Hitler's cutlery on my dinner was too much. I passed the comment, of which I doubt the veracity, that Canadian soldiers were discouraged from taking souvenirs and was considered looting by my country. It was meant to insult, and it worked. We had no further contact. Beware of geeks bearing gifts. David Emerson is the man who sold Canada down the river on softwood lumber right on the heels of betraying his riding's voters. They elected him to Parliament as a Liberal, then he immediately joined the Conservative caucus. Today, the now former Conservative Trade Minister has a cushy seat as CEO of the BC Transmission Corporation, a crown corporation spun off from BC Hydro. Why anyone listens to this treacherous bugger is beyond me. He's presently promoting a customs union with the United States of America, which he claims will shelter Canada from the vagaries of the U.S. political system. Where have I heard this tune before? Brian Mulroney used the same pitch to sell us on the free trade agreement and then NAFTA. I have news for Emperor Emerson. No agreement will insulate little Canada from American politics. As Trudeau said so succinctly, dealing with the U.S. is like sleeping with an elephant. The last 8 years have seen the abolition of the world's longest undefended border. No customs union or any other agreement will pry that border open as long as Americans remain paranoid. And their paranoia will continue as long as they have real fanatical enemies in the world. They will have these lethal enemies as long as they maintain over 700 military bases overseas. They continue with aggressive foreign wars. They anger Muslims by unstinting support of Israel and threaten the world's peace with a military consuming as much as the rest of the world's forces combined. The leopard will not change its spots, and neither Obama nor anyone else can change the momentum of American aggression within one or two administrations. The U.S. will keep its borders tight, making trade with them difficult and expensive. Emerson and anyone else interested in building Canadian exports would be well advised to look elsewhere for increased trade and fair treatment. I'm convinced that North Americans were exposed to too many Western movies during their formative years. In those movies, the good and bad cowboys could be identified by the color of their toppings. The guys with the white hats were pure of heart and could fight the evil-intentioned black hats without becoming bloody or even dusty. They shot guns from the hands of the evil ones without causing injury. We like to believe that nations as well as people can be identified as black hats or white hats. We, of course, are white hats, always. We may make mistakes, but our intentions are always the best. Our world is infested with black hats, a confusing category as countries move from black to white and back again. When I was a baby, Germany, Japan, and Italy were coal black. Now they're lily white. While the World War raged, Russians were valiantly resisting the terrible Nazis. Suddenly, when Truman dropped the bomb on Japan, the Soviet Union became an evil empire, donning a dusky lid. Back and forth go countries from one category of haberdashery to another, and we citizens, like the hero of Orwell's 1984, try to keep up. In 1972, I traveled through Iran, then a white hat country under the nasty Shah. In 1979, it changed hats with a popular revolution, overthrowing that good tyrant and installing a bad tyrant, white to black. On the 30th anniversary of that revolution, today's Tehran black hats launched a satellite from a made-at-home rocket. While such an achievement by a white-capped nation would be celebrated, when done by Iran, it is a threat to world peace. Such an achievement is declared to leave that rogue nation but a small step from launching nuclear weapons onto the territory of such peaceful countries as Israel, or even that bastion of international cooperation and joy, the United States. Doomsayers claim that at the rate Iran is enriching uranium, they could soon build a bomb or two in each year. If they did, by the year 2109, they would have as many bombs as Israel has today. And by 7009, they might equal America's current arsenal. Tremble, ye nations of our world. When the U.S. had a nuclear monopoly, their bombs were instruments maintaining peace in the world. Then the black-capped Soviets built their own bomb. It was a threat, as their intentions were purely evil. More recently, North Korea set off an atomic explosion and the free world shuddered. Who knows, but the current Kim might load it one onto an ox cart and deliver it to the Washington Monument. Our friend Israel, upholder of international law and order in the Middle East, has a couple hundred of their own weapons of mass destruction, but this is fine as they have a record of peaceful relations with their neighbors. Russia launched Sputnik while I was in high school in the States, and our nation was shocked by the impending violation of world peace, that is to say, American hegemony. Soon thereafter, our own pet turncoat, Wernher von Braun, father of Hitler's V-1 and V-2 rockets, put a satellite into orbit. This was no threat, despite the credentials of its creator, as he now shared our white hat. Canadians, just like everyone else, believe that we are the good guys. Blind Freddy could see otherwise. We've joined the United States in an unjustifiable war against Afghanistan. We could hold a plenary meeting of our active peacekeepers in a phone booth. We blindly support Israeli aggression. Even while our government held itself aloof from America's Vietnam War, we were major suppliers of armaments to their military. Claire Culhane, a late friend of ours, was administrator of a Canadian-funded hospital in Vietnam, and she saw the horrors of that war up close. She returned to write a book about Canadian complicity entitled, Why is Canada in Vietnam? That slammed our role in the war. For an ongoing example of how our hat has been muddied, look at the way we've treated our natives. I hate to upset the apple cart and hurt anyone's feelings, but the nations of our world are neither black nor white, but come in all shades of gray. That statement in itself is a white lie. I do want to hurt feelings on this issue, if that's what thinking causes. A troubling announcement came from Conservative Member of Parliament Rod Bruinage of Winnipeg. He claimed that a secret cross-party caucus exists within the House composed of those members opposing abortion. Secret. When voters choose their candidates, it seems reasonable to rely on the platform promoted by their party. We want our member to support its planks. New Democrats officially favor freedom of choice. Liberals fall back on saying the matter has been decided by the courts. Many conservatives oppose women's rights but won't touch the issue publicly. Who knows where the bloc stands? Personally, I usually mark the space for a new Democrat, assuming that he or she will carry the party flag and support a woman's right to her body. I would be less than happy to find this member was running off to secret meetings to undermine my wishes. What other secret caucuses does our parliament harbor? Is there one promoting economic merger with the U.S., perhaps adopting their dollar? Is there one in favor of making Canada a police state? We deserve assurances that people elected to represent us don't have hidden agendas opposing our interests. This is probably too much to wish at a time when we have a prime minister who hides his cards, playing them craftily in hopes of duping us into giving him a majority. If he gets that majority, we'll see those cards, and we may not like them. Since I am well past my best before date, and I am no longer in the job market, I can afford to rewrite my resume. Truthfully. After the boilerplate stuff identifying myself, I can launch into the usual history, but with explanatory footnotes. For instance, my revised resume would begin with, I graduated 7th in my class from a private boarding high school in upstate New York. Footnote, my parents were invited to remove me from public school after I pulled such stunts as taking a hand grenade and a pistol to class. I was tied for 7th in my graduating class, but there were only 21 of us that year. I attended Bucknell University as an engineering candidate for one semester before withdrawing and enlisting in the United States Army. Footnote, I flunked out and took the easy way out. The military taught me valuable skills in supply management and organizational operations. Footnote, I learned how to create a niche and hide within it. I learned to detest the officer class. I learned that I should never volunteer for anything, especially jungle warfare training. Upon discharge, I worked briefly in a division of our local town maintenance operations. Footnote, I spent a summer walking around town painting all storm sewer catch basins green. I then worked for the Port of New York Authority, distributing resources. Footnote, I was a messenger. I was admitted to Ryder College, studying business administration. Footnote, I found an institution that would take anyone who could fog a mirror. After 2 years, I was able to transfer to an Ivy League university where I earned a degree in labor relations. Footnote, I achieved good grades by fooling professors as to my abilities. I spent a year of practical learning about unions working for the United States Steel Corporation in Gary, Indiana. Footnote, I was burned out by studying, so I took a job as a laborer picking Gary based on a Time magazine article on how corrupt the city was. With this practical experience, I enrolled in Cornell University to pursue a master's degree in labor relations. I separated from that program to gain more practical labor relations experience. Footnote, I flunked out again, bugging off to Canada, where the best I could do was get a mining job in Sudbury. After a few months of this experience in Sudbury, learning operations from the bottom up, I accepted an invitation from an old friend to try to apply my talents in California. Footnote, INCO taught me from the bottom, all right. I worked drilling and blasting under 450 meters of granite. I lunged at a chance to work in daylight. I worked for 2 years in Oakland, California, employed by Graybar Electric, rising from warehouseman through sales to buyer for an entire operation. Footnote, I was forced from the warehouse to counter sales, where I ran my tail off serving walk-in customers. I refused promotion to a telephone sales desk, so they moved me the dead-end buyer's job. A quest for adventure led me to emigrate to greater opportunities in Australia. Footnote, my romantic life fell apart and the job bored me silly. Australia was as far away as I could get. I gained further experience in work and travel down under and was anxious to return to California. Footnote, dead-end jobs and hitchhiking around the country made me realize I didn't fit in down there, except for my developing an alarming affinity for the local beer. I returned to Graybar Electric, where I worked for another 2 years before accepting an offer of employment in Prince George. Footnote, I was bored silly in California and disgusted with American politics. A friend who'd moved to Prince George before me offered me to work in a warehouse. I've been employed by E.B. Horseman & Son in Prince George, by the Unemployment Insurance Commission, by School District 57 as a substitute teacher, and finally by British Columbia Corrections before retiring from the latter in 1995. Footnote: I left Horseman's to spend a summer driving and camping around North America, returning in hopes of enjoying a spell of loafing on unemployment insurance. Instead, I was offered a job by the UIC as a stock boy, a job I could not refuse without losing benefits. I neglected to mention a couple years spent in Victoria living on savings. Then I returned to Prince George in search of a secure job with a pension, as I was not growing younger. 2 days as a substitute teacher, and I quit before killing one or more students. I landed at the local Cross Bar Hotel, swinging keys before finding my way into a cushy stores job. I retired precipitously, actually quitting with a pension, when the job became unbearable due to actions of ignorant and arrogant administration persons who will not be named. I married my soulmate 26 years ago, and we now live happily and quietly on a rural property outside of town. Footnote: we met at work. She fell for me on our first date when I got hopelessly drunk, fell in her apartment's pool, and passed out in her bed, alone. I bonded with her when visiting the local police lockup, where she was being held on suspicion of attempted murder of her estranged husband. Ours was a match made in heaven. Since my retirement, I've pursued homekeeping, travel, and a volunteer career in broadcasting. Footnote: I mow lawns, shovel snow, and haul firewood while keeping our property from falling into ruin. Travel is randomly ricocheting as opportunity presents itself, and the broadcast bit is self-explanatory. Would you hire me? I don't hear much any longer about the world's longest undefended border, do you? Remember that? It used to run north of Washington State across to Maine. Those were the old days. I first crossed that border from the U.S. by boat on Lake Champlain when we sailed from New York to Quebec unchallenged. The next time was driving to Expo at 67 when I was waved across the border. Then in 69, when I drove to Vancouver without formalities. Back then, our nations were considered neighbors, good neighbors, who could visit each other without arousing suspicions. No longer. Now Canadians headed south are considered to be terrorists until proven otherwise. The border has been militarized. The latest nail in a coffin of friendly, trustful relations is the patrol of our border by Predator drone aircraft, the same ones that overfly Pakistani territory, launching missile strikes on suspicious activities like wedding parties and homes pinpointed by dubious collaborators. These Predator drones will fly from 5 different U.S. bases, each assigned a portion of our undefended border. Will these drones on our frontier be armed with missiles? Of course not. These are friendly predators, merely observing suspicious activities on Canadian territory. Once spotted, armed force will be dispatched, but that's a different issue. The U.S. has already constructed a huge apartheid wall, similar in many respects to Israel's, along the border with Mexico. The only thing preventing such a construction on our border is the daunting geography involved. We asked for it when we became a haven for terrorists, eh? This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. British Columbia is experimenting with new driver's licenses, bowing to the American paranoia about border identification. Some 521 citizens have been issued these documents containing radio frequency identification chips to be read by American border officers. When the bearer of one of these licenses approaches a border post, a device reads information encoded in the chip and the bearer is identified. Sounds like a great idea, on the surface. The devices communicating with chips can read them from a distance of 4.5 meters, revealing a coded number that is used, in turn, to access a Canadian site instantly. That site gives the personal information that the Americans want. This system is secure, so they say, but I recall what the nerds tell us. Anything that someone can invent, another can circumvent. I, for one, do not relish packing a card which a hacker could conceivably use to strip me of personal information without my ever knowing. Do you have faith that no one will find a way to steal identities through cleverly hacking the system? If you believe this, please switch off your radio and proceed to the nearest casino, where fortune awaits you. Here are two facts to ponder. One, the United States wants the petroleum from Alberta's tar sands. Two, they want Canada's water. So let's tie these loose ends together. Mining and processing bitumen from tar sands generates as much as 25 billion liters of toxically polluted water each year. This sullies the northern Alberta landscape in massive artificial lakes, lakes that are leaking into the Peace River Basin. So for each pipeline carrying bitumen south to feed American SUVs, let's require a parallel line carrying water, slightly used water now dumped into these lakes of waste. Tell them they can't have the one without the other. Once the waste is safely across the 49th, they can separate the precious water from poisons, and they can figure a way to store or salvage that waste. Problem solved. Victory is in sight in our war against Afghanistan. Pass that bong again, please. No, Victoria, this is not about to happen in your lifetime. Afghans licked the British, they licked the Russians, and they will bloody well lick our puny coalition of the killing. Oh, there are lots of plans to win this war, the war that's gone on longer than either the U.S. Civil War, World War I, or World War II. From the looks of it, it will outlast the Cold War. President Obama will be sending 30,000 more Yankee occupiers to the unfortunate nation. He's arm-twisting NATO nations to contribute ever more soldiers to the war. He can count on Canada to break yet another commitment, the one that will withdraw our troops by 2011. What the hell, that was just one promise among many useless promises. Some clever buggers advocate giving thousands of guns to Afghan forces recruited to act as surrogates in our war. Does anyone believe that these guns will not turn up in the hands of those shooting NATO forces? If so, please refer to my previous casino comment. I predict that someday in the not-too-distant future, in spite of hundreds of Allied deaths and billions of dollars wasted, a determined Afghan resistance will again rout occupiers. I passed through Herat, Kandahar, and Kabul in the 70s. With that experience behind me, I predicted that the Russians would meet their own Vietnam-type debacle there. I was right. Now I extend that suggestion to the NATO operation. The Afghans are tough and determined. That country will not be occupied by foreigners until the last breathing Afghan is dead and buried. Period. It's interesting to see how decisions of our politicians are skewed by ideology. Take our dear Premier's adherence to the pursuit of his P3 projects, even when it's determined that they're merely conduits for transferring public control and profits from the people to corporations. It's no secret that such schemes transfer public assets like schools, bridges, and roads from communal ownership to private hands, giving these owners a bloated long-term return guaranteed by government. An example of an ideological capture is the planned replacement of the Portman Bridge on Highway 1 in the Fraser Valley. No one who has dealt with traffic on this span during rush hours will doubt the need to relieve its congestion. But a $3.3 billion replacement for the bridge is not the sole option for relief. The province could have taken a lesson from the San Francisco Bay Area. They built their BART system, running trains from the suburbs down the medians of highways. Commuters sitting in idling cars can watch their neighbors whisking by in comfort, reading their newspapers. This system got a lot of people out of cars. British Columbia's Highway 1 has a comfortable median that could support such a high-speed railway. Government policy could actively discourage spread of homes to far-flung suburbs. Greater population density on the Vancouver side of the Fraser could make new crossings unimportant. But Campbell's pushing ahead with his new plan. Rather than twinning the Portman, he intends to replace the current bridge with a 10-lane structure charging a $3 toll. This income stream will not, of course, accrue to the public purse, but to a private corporation. Instead of having the government build this bridge, assuming that it's necessary, by floating a bond issue, Campbell has turned it over to corporate friends of the Liberals. We could easily issue bonds and pay them off with toll income, leaving the public span as a legacy. No, Campbell is giving it to private interests as a chokehold on our highway system. Campbell's Portman ambition has reached a stumbling block. The consortium of companies to build this structure has had trouble raising enough money. Campbell will therefore lend $1 billion public dollars to the companies to build a bridge originally budgeted at $1.5 billion that will belong to private interests, charging tolls that will line their pockets. This concept emanates from a government elected on a platform of fiscal wisdom and probity. Forget about it. These guys won't be happy until every last piece of public property is sold off and leased back to us for private profit. We're told that the principal aim of various rescue packages is the restoration of public confidence in the economic system. Once that is achieved, citizens will return to their former profligate habits, blowing money thoughtlessly, maxing their credit cards, driving up housing prices, and restoring former apparent prosperity. Indians, that is dot, not feather, have an old saying that strikes me as apropos. They say that confidence grows gradually, as does the palm tree. It falls at the rate that the coconut falls. It would take a long time to restore faith of workers and consumers. And should that faith return? We need a good dose of skepticism, not faith, prompting people to live within their means and even save for a rainy day. Overconfidence is a greater enemy of prosperity than a healthy cynicism. Thus endeth this reading of Uncle Don's Porcupine Petting Zoo number 303. Tune in to CFUR at 88.7 FM next week for another dose of reality unseasoned with faith or sanguine expectations.